Fire season, of course, is upon us, meaning we and the people who fight fires are bracing for that spark that lights several thousand acres on fire. We've seen some big, nasty fires over the years, but it is possible that the issue is less about the fires than how we characterize them. For example, calling them big, nasty fires. Are they really nasty to the ecosystem through which they burn? The question is raised and answered in a big new book that turns some of the conventional wisdom about bigger, hotter fires on its head. The book is called The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix. It is the work of about two dozen authors and two editors. Dominic Della Sala is the president and chief scientist of the Geos Institute based in Ashland. He's in the studio with me. Dominic, welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Jeffrey, and thanks for scrolling through the book. It's hot off the press, and you're one of the first to actually look through it.
It is a very comprehensive book. The other editor is Chad Hansen. He's the director and staff ecologist at the John Muir Project of the Earth Island Institute. Joins us by phone. Hi, Chad.
Hi, good morning.
So this is a massive project. I mean, how did it get off the ground? Let's start with that one, Dominic.
Well, you know, it's curious to me. It comes down to a hike that I was taking one day with my 10-year-old up to Grizzly Peak. And folks that have been up to Grizzly Peak see the beauty in that forest that has come back from a fire in 2002. And without even talking to my daughter about it, she saw the magnificence in that burn area with lots of woodpeckers, butterflies, dragonflies, tons of wildflowers. And I thought, you know, if my 10-year-old can get it, I got to get this information out there. And then Chad and I hooked up, got a bunch of scientists together, got a firefighter to write a chapter in the book, some policy analysts, and we were off to the races, finished the book in about 6 months.
Really? All right. It helps when you have 24 different authors. You can send them all in different directions. Chad Hansen, who is the book for?
It's really for everybody. I mean, it's certainly for the scientists and environmental managers, in federal and state agencies. It's for policymakers. It's for environmental reporters. But it's also for the general public. We wanted to make this book accessible. There's a certain, obviously, technical component to it. But we tried to write in a way that would make it, digestible to members of the general public who are interested in these issues, because we think it's really important to bridge the gap between the science and what people think and understand about fire.
So it's not exactly a mass sort of book in that sense. I mean, it is closer, I would think, to an academic work. There are lots of footnotes and things like that, but it is accessible too, I have to say that. And Dominic, tell us about all the people who contributed. We mentioned about two dozen people is what I got to count up to.
Yeah, it was really a global effort. And we had scientists that have been working on fire ecology now for several decades out in the field. And most of it was organized around the fires in Western North America, but we have examples from Central Europe, from Southeastern Australia, from Sub-Saharan Africa, all places around the globe that experience these large, intense burns. And the consensus in the writings of the scientists in this book is that these are not ecological disasters. I mean, there's definitely a human element, and we could coexist, which is what the theme of the book is about. But, you know, we see over and over again that these forests and shrublands are quite resilient and depend on these very beneficial ecological forest fires.
So the essence of the book is that just because it's a big, scary fire doesn't mean that it's a bad thing for a forest?
That's right. And, you know, we're not trying to downplay the human element at all. There are ways to live safely in fire country. And certainly it's a disaster when a home or lives are at risk, and there are ways to prevent those disasters. But from an ecological standpoint, those fires are very beneficial. They've been going on for millennia, and nature is very resilient to them. That's the whole notion of nature's phoenix.
We'll get into some of the finer points later on, but I mean, and people are thinking, wait a minute, you're talking about even the fires that sterilize the soil they burn so hot, those are good for forests too?
Yes, and they don't really sterilize the soils. They can cook them in places, but you know, most of these big fires are very spotty in terms of their intensities. They're not one large charred landscape. And that's the whole notion of a mixed severity burn. You've got patches of low severity, moderate severity, and high severity where most of the trees have been killed and the soils have been heavily scorched. But it's not one big scorched landscape. I want to get that point across. When we see that kind of mosaic pattern in nature, it's chock full of wildlife habitat.
All right. So one of the things that we can disabuse people of right away is the idea that when you hear, you know, burned 100,000 acres, they're not all burned evenly.
That's right. There's a lot of variety in that. If you were flying over it in the plane, you would see all mixed up burn patches shortly after the fire. You know, here's the other real surprising fact, and I want to get Chad to comment on this. But, you know, it reminds me of the Monty Python movie, I'm Not Dead Yet. And this is what we're seeing in a lot of these forest fires, that when you go out the next season, those trees are not really dead. And Chad's done a lot of work on that.
It's in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Anybody who came of age in the 1970s can recite that scene completely. So Chad, this is one of the major points of the book, then, is that the forest is not dead yet.
Yeah, exactly. I appreciate, by the way, the reference to Monty Python. Obviously, there are places where the fire kills the trees immediately. You know, so no question, those are really the active crown fire areas. And you know those areas, right off the bat, because basically the flames went all the way up to the tops of the trees and above. And so basically, even the upper crowns of the trees, all the needles were actually consumed. So those trees are definitely fire-killed trees. However, much of the area that is initially mapped as high severity, meaning mapped as areas where most or all the trees are killed, much of that is actually comprised of trees that look dead but are not. And you know these trees because they have brown needles on the top of the crown as opposed to basically being black all the way up. And those trees, they look dead because you don't have any live needles left. But the terminal buds at the end of the branches survive. In many cases, especially in the pines, but many other species have other similar adaptations. And basically, 1 year after the fire in the first spring, they start producing new green needles. And the survival of those trees, we call this flushing, and the survival rate of those trees is very, very high. I published a study on this back in 2009, and it was about 88% of them survived long-term.
All right, we'll come back and talk more about the ecological importance of mixed-severity fires with its editors Chad Hansen and Dominic Della Sala, and take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about wildfire today and the oft-made assumption that if a wildfire burns very big and very hot, it's bad for the ecosystem. Our guests today say no, that's not necessarily true, and in fact, often isn't. Dominic Della Sala is the president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute based in Ashland. Chad Hansen is the director and staff ecologist at the John Muir Project of Earth Island Institute. Joins us by phone. We're talking about the book they co-edited called The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix. It's the work of about 24 authors, and these two editors put it together. Join us on the exchange with your questions and comments about fire in the ecosystem, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. The first place I went, Chad Hansen, was to the back of the book and the words there about how differently people view forests, which is sort of a great beginning point, too. We think of them in different terms depending on our relationships to the forest.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, sometimes people have entirely different conversations about the same thing depending upon their perspective. It's like they're speaking different languages. You know, if you view the forest as simply a timber commodity, you might have one conversation. If you view it ecologically, you might have a completely different conversation. You know, and one of the things that's so important to understand, and this is a key focus of the book, is that, you know, in these areas where fire does burn hotter, in these high-intensity fire patches within that low and moderate intensity mosaic within a forest fire, those areas where most or all the trees are killed, that's extremely important habitat. It's actually very comparable in terms of biodiversity and wildlife abundance to old-growth forest, which very few people realize. And it's even rarer than old-growth forest on the landscape across western forest because of fire suppression and post-fire logging.
So let me get that again. A place where all the trees have been killed is an important habitat?
Yes. Yeah, it's very important habitat. It's actually some of the most important forest habitat that we have in our western conifer forests. And this, you know, is relatively unknown until, even among scientists studying this, until fairly recently. You know, most of the research on this has been done in the last 10 or 15 years. And so the rise of the research on this has just been meteoric over the last decade.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about in the book about how differently people view forests. I remember a discussion about the West Side Fire Recovery Plan in the Klamath National Forest a few months ago, and the forest supervisor identified the areas that burned in the Happy Camp complex as clear cut. But they were standing dead trees. But you're saying the trees might not necessarily be dead there. But the larger point is that people do view forests very differently.
Yeah, and that's a really good example because, you know, let's take the example, not of the places where the trees initially look dead but are not, but the areas where the fire really does kill the trees initially, you know, the active crown fire areas. You know, what we call that is complex early seral forest. You know, that's the scientific term. The little more informal term is snag forest habitat. But we've come to understand that the levels of native biodiversity and wildlife abundance in these areas is incredibly high. You know, it looks like a barren landscape, you know, days or weeks after a fire. You know, you see these beds of ash on the ground and these fire-killed trees. But by the first spring after the fire, and for many, many springs thereafter, you know, for 30-plus years after, what you see is this incredible growth of natural conifer generation, native flowering shrubs, wildflowers, and oaks, and all kinds of growth in this wonderful mix of woodpeckers and flycatchers and warblers, bats, hawks, spotted owls foraging actively in these areas because the shrub habitat and the down logs are such great habitat for their small mammal prey. And so it's this very rich ecosystem. The bears get fat on the berries produced by the shrubs, the deer browse in the undergrowth. And of course, the woodpeckers create nest cavities, new ones every year, and that provides homes for bluebirds and nuthatches and all kinds of other species that need cavities but can't excavate their own.
I guess you could call it the subtitle of the book, or just the end of the title, is Nature's Phoenix. So this is the beginning of the book, Dominic Della Sala, where you go mythological on us with the phoenix. Explain the reference.
Well, you know, the mythology meets science in this case, because what we looked at was the whole myth of the phoenix. And in a nutshell, the phoenix is a mythical bird that it gets to a point of about 500 years old, and it's on its last leg, so to speak. So it builds a nest, and it calls upon the sun to burn itself, realizing that it's going to rise in brilliance out of the ashes. And, you know, of course, the flip side of that is, from a scientific standpoint, this is exactly what we see after a forest fire. And time since fire really makes a difference. Most of the news coverage goes in when the flames are bearing down, and you very seldomly get any coverage the next spring, a year later, 10 years later, and you see a whole different environment out there. You really do see this wonderful phoenix that has emerged from these big fires.
It's kind of like a lot of news stories that the major media tend to focus on when they are still, in this case, technically hot, literally hot.
Yeah.
But they don't come back later. And yet you have actually, I understand, taken a couple of crews into places, like a CNN crew into the Biscuit Fire aftermath months later. And tell us about the reactions of the members of the crew.
There was a lot of surprise. And, you know, just to see the seedlings coming out of the ground and, you know, shrubs and wildflowers, and a lot of folks didn't expect that, because they only see these large plains with air tankers and, you know, flame retardants dropping down on big fires, but they don't come back to see what nature does after these forest fires, which is really remarkable.
So, like the phoenix, is a forest reborn as it was before, or does it sometimes turn out very different in its new incarnation?
Well, you know, it really depends. And often it comes back the way nature designed it, because these forests were born to burn. And, you know, fire is to dry forest as rain is to rainforest. There's a codependency there. But, you know, we've got to look at what's going to happen with climate change. And we really don't know, as we were rolling the dice on climate change, we're changing the top-down driver of fire behavior, which is extreme weather events. And the more we see that, and the more those events happen, we don't really know what the future holds in terms of how these ecosystems are going to adapt.
Chad Hansen, would you like to see the phoenix replace Smokey the Bear?
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Yes, I would. You know, I think what we need to do is really, you know, kind of redefine the way we view fire in the forest, and also the relationship between communities in these forested areas and wildland fire. And I think our focus over the past several decades has been out there, into the backcountry, suppress those fires, stop those fires because they're destroying the forest. I think we need to reshift our focus to protect communities, to protect homes, and let fire be fire in the backcountry, because it's doing really good, important, beneficial ecological work. But right now we're diverting a lot of scarce resources away from true home protection.
So a couple of things to clear up in the first place, and you just sort of hinted at one. We're not talking about just forest ecosystems, but any place where wildfire burns, right?
Well, it depends. I mean, in forests, the research is telling us that we have a very substantial fire deficit relative to natural levels before fire suppression. And this deficit extends not just to low-intensity fire, but also to moderate and high-intensity fire. So we need more post-fire habitat in these forests. A lot of wildlife species have evolved over millennia to depend upon the various habitat structures and elements created by high-intensity fire, the snags, the down logs, the shrubs, and natural conifer generation. But there are ecosystems in North America that actually have too much fire, such as Southern California, low-elevation chaparral. Just because there's so many people, there's so many unplanned ignitions that there's actually too much fire in that system.
All right. So the other question then was what you guys mean by mixed severity fires. Yeah, I'll give that to Dominic.
Okay. Well, again, it's like that mosaic pattern that I mentioned earlier on. If you fly over these forest fires a year after they burn or shortly after they burn, you see a very complex pattern of some spots that all the trees were killed. And those are high severity. Other spots where, you know, some of the trees were killed, and those are moderate severity. And other places either that were unburned or lowly burned in terms of, you know, the understory vegetation was affected by the fire. So you put that all together, and you got this big mosaic or patch quilt of fire severities. And severity, of course, is influenced by the intensity of the burn. Does that make sense?
It does. Do you guys ever actually say that was a bad fire? I mean, are all fires good fires, in your opinion?
Well, it's not a question of good or bad. It's just, you know, nature has designed these forests for fire. They can't coexist without it. But we do see areas where fires burn uncharacteristically. And where that happens most often is in the tree plantations, because the trees are densely packed in those areas.
And their heights are similar, too.
Yeah, and so when fire hits them, it just blows up. And we've seen this over and over again in our region.
The book we're talking about is called The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix. Dominic Della Sala and Chad Hansen are the co-editors and have about, and among the two dozen or so authors. Geos Institute President and Chief Scientist, that's Dominic Della Sala. Chad Hansen is the Director and Staff Ecologist at the John Muir Project of Earth Island Institute. Join this discussion on The Exchange. They're really turning things on their head, the conventional wisdom on its head, as we talk about the fact that fire really has a purpose, no matter how big and ugly it gets from a human perspective. Join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Jay in Walterville writes about, you were talking about chaparral just a moment ago, Chad. Jay writes that Southern California's rejuvenation by fire is a natural cycle in the chaparral. He talks about the O'Neill Ranch land near San Juan Capistrano was beautiful a couple of years after a fire. And he writes about Ceanothus in particular. He says, I believe it requires fire to germinate. Can you shed some light on that, Chad?
Oh, yeah, that's a really important comment. And just to be clear, you know, chaparral throughout California, the low, whether it's montane chaparral in the, up in the mountain forest, or it's low-elevation chaparral, it has an incredibly strong relationship with fire. You know, it's inextricably linked. In fact, a lot of chaparral species depend upon intense fire to actually catalyze germination. And so chaparral regenerates wonderfully after fire. It actually is, you know, basically depends upon fire for its existence. But the only, my point was really just that, you know, because there are so many unplanned ignitions in the populated areas, particularly of Southern California, there are areas where you're having fires in such a rapid succession that the chaparral doesn't have a chance to reach reproductive maturity after the last fire. And that can be a problem. But in general, ecologically, oh yeah, chaparral is, its fire is very important to chaparral.
And Dominic, aren't there some species of evergreens that conifers that don't release their seeds under a certain temperature?
Yeah, that's a great point. So there are a number of conifers that are really resilient to fires. They will die. The parent will die, but it will release its seed base when there's a hot burn that goes through an area. In our region, lodgepole pine, knobcone pine are good examples of that. And we also have examples of giant sequoia. That tree was not only born to burn, but it was born to resist fire. It's one of the most resistant conifers in the world. When you get these thousand-year-old trees, they can even tolerate a crown fire. They're so resistant to fire.
Wow, that's impressive. Let's take a call from John in Veneta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about fires in the wildlands with Dominic Della Sala and Chad Hansen.
Good morning, guys. Yeah, in my younger days, I was a wildfire fighter, and one of our concerns, and again, this was in the Cascades, and it was when they were still knocking the virgin forest down. So this was huge trees with super steep canyons with sometimes just massive debris, just incredible kindle waiting to happen. So there are some dynamics here, but I didn't hear all this show. I'm curious about is the sterilization of soil, because they really laid that on us. They wanted us to really knock it down as fast as we could, especially these ones that were strips cut way up a really steep canyon wall that would go up a long ways, and even before they did the 30-some acre minimum or maximum for the size. And the heat that would be generated by the time that fire built up and got to the top was just unbelievable. And I was just wondering how this would fit in. And then, oh, you already mentioned it some, but the dog hair, the dense packs of reprod that has been neglected all over the place, that just drives me nuts. Anyway, if you could address that, I'd sure appreciate it. Thanks.
A bunch of good stuff there. Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Dominic?
Yeah, thank you for that comment, and thank you for the work that you've done in the past on this. We actually have a chapter in the book that was written by a former firefighter, Tim Inglesby. And he directs the FUSE organization, Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. And so he's written it from that standpoint. And I think it's really important to know that, again, when these large fires burn, you're going to get some patches that are going to cook soils and cook vegetation, and other patches that are going to be really spotty. So this has been going on for a very long time, and in those very cooked patches, the soils are going to take longer periods to recover, and they're also going to be influenced by their surroundings. So you get a lot of movement of organisms, and you get a lot of subsurface ecology that's going on that is going to repopulate those heavily burned areas over time. And the soils are really important because they take a lifetime, a human lifetime, to regenerate in places. So yeah, it's definitely something to be aware of. I'm more concerned, however, about the impacts that happen after a fire. Post-fire logging, roads have much more sediment delivery to creeks than a fire event. A fire event's going to give you a pulse of sediment flow into the creeks over time that will actually be beneficial to a lot of aquatic organisms. We have a chapter in the book on that. But a post-fire logging operation and roads are a chronic delivery of sediment that the streams can't handle.
Not a pulse, but more like a torrent or something.
It's ongoing. It just keeps happening as long as you have those roads in place, and especially roads that are failing over time.
Even without the sediment loads, the issue of salvage logging always gets to be a big one. Well, for a number of reasons, but which raises the question in my mind, how sensitive is the ecosystem? As the forest is returning to life and attempting to grow, and you see the woodpeckers and the birds and the flowers and all the things that are sprouting up there, is this a system that really needs to be left alone for a while?
I think so. You know, it really depends on the situation. I would think that what we've learned through decades of research is that these fire-dependent systems are all linked together by time. So what we do in that forest after it burns will affect that forest for centuries. And so after a fire, that fire has created that snag habitat. And those snags will lifeboat the forest from when it's coming back to when it's an old-growth forest. If we take those old trees out, live or dead, which is what normally happens in post-fire logging, you get a different system that comes back. It's very fragile. The soils are fragile. And we've seen repeatedly that the logging not only eliminates the most important ecological habitat, but it leaves behind the slash. And those slash piles blow up when a forest fire hits. Real quickly, the fire that took place last year east of the Green Springs Inn, that blew up when
Oregon
it hit.
The Oregon Gulch Fire?
Right. It blew up when it hit slash piles that were piled over 12 feet high from logging operations. So that's where we see uncharacteristically severe fires. It's after a fire event that has gone through post-fire logging, leaving behind the logging slash, and the next fire just blows up when it hits that slash.
Chad, there's a line in the book, scientific controversy is what often transforms status quo understandings about nature. What would you say is the chief controversy here?
Well, I think that the controversy mostly at its root stems from the gap between what people believe about fires and what the science is now telling us. You know, like I said, the rise in our knowledge about about the ecological importance of mixed-intensity fires has been so rapid over the past decade. But it's happened so quickly that we just haven't had enough time really to close that gap. And I think that's where the controversy is. And so you'll get people applying management decisions on the ground based upon past assumptions when they conflict with the science. And I think that's where conflict arises.
So quickly before we hit the break, Dominic, the idea that forests need help recovering from fire, is there a true-false answer there?
I think there is. And I think, you know, forest recovered when they burned. And a lot of wildlife depend on a forest fire. So from their vantage point, recovery happened right after the flames went out.
All right. Much more to talk about with Dominic Della Sala and Chad Hansen, the co-editors of the book, The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix. A lot more to talk about with you, too, if you'd like to join this conversation on The Exchange. You're welcome to join us by phone or by email when we return from the break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Dominic and Chad and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking today about fires in wildlands, primarily in forests, and today's guests are ripping up the playbook on us. They've written their own book called The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix. It's actually a collaboration by 24 authors with scientific backgrounds. The editors are Dominic Della Sala, who is the Geos Institute president and chief scientist based in Ashland. He's in the studio with me. Chad Hansen is director and staff ecologist at the John Muir Project of the Earth Island Institute based in Southern California. He joins us by phone, and you can join us by phone as well. The number here is 800-838-3760 as we talk about correct approaches to forest and wild ecosystems after fires, and you can also join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. I'll give those again, 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. It appears you're not just trying to change the viewpoint here, but the language itself, Dominic. Would you give some examples there?
Yeah, you know, I even think conservation groups are guilty of this. They talk about fires being catastrophic, a disaster. And, you know, that's the kind of language we need to purge. Another example is the term salvage. You hear that a lot about the agencies. We're going to salvage log. And when you look up that term on the Merriam-Webster's dictionary, salvage is to take value from something that's valueless. And that is as far from the truth as possible. These are the most valued ecosystems, the big trees, live or dead. They're not being salvaged. They're being destroyed.
All right. And you do not spare the news media, I notice. You refer to the fire-phobic media. And I can think back to some of my own discussions in the news in years past about, for example, looking at the aftermath of the it was the Hull Mountain Fire, I think, or the East Evans Creek. And Wilcox Peak, I reported saying, looked like a bomb hit it. That's not necessarily a bad thing, you're saying.
Right. And, you know, I've heard terms like moonscapes. You know, we had that debate during the Biscuit Fire. It's not a moonscape. It's an ecological kaleidoscope of living plants and wildlife that are in different stages of post-fire regeneration. And so I think we really need to change the language in terms of how we describe this purely on an objective basis and less so on a subjective.
I believe one of the claims I read in this book, though, is that mixed and high severity fires have not increased. Is that one of the claims you're making?
One of the surprise findings of the book. You hear this a lot. Oh, my goodness. You know, these big, severe fires are increasing across the West. And it really depends on your time interval. A lot of the studies that have been done only go back as far as maybe the 1980s in the majority of the cases. And there's been an uptick in the size of fires in places since the 1980s, but not the severity of fires. If you go further back and start looking at the general land surveys and you look at the historical accounts of when the first European settlers came over, there was a lot more acres burning in the West than there is today. And they were burning very similarly in terms of severity back then as they are today.
So is severity a function of temperature, a function of height of flames, where in the forest vertically that it burns, or all the above?
It's a combination of factors, but what we're seeing increasingly in the fires across the West is they're being driven largely by extreme weather events. So fire behavior is influenced by topography, vegetation, which a lot of people call fuels, but we like to look at it as vegetation, and climate. And so as the climate warms, we're going to see an increasing influence of global warming on how these fires behave. And you hear a lot about, well, we just need to thin and we're going to log our way out of this. And unless we solve the cause, global warming, we cannot treat the effect, uncharacteristic fires. So we've got to do something about lowering our burning of fossil fuel emissions and deforestation, which are the two biggest causes of global warming today.
Chad, Dominic was just talking about one of the biggest surprises. What were some of the others you guys had as you assembled all the work for this book?
Well, I think that's certainly one of the key ones. The fact that even the largest fires that have been characterized as mega fires, and we sort of really take a very close look at this in the book and say, okay, let's look at this concept of mega fires. These very large fires that are very intense. First off, are they increasing in recent decades? And while fire overall has increased in many areas, the largest fires and the most intense fires are actually not, and that's interesting. And also, as Dominic mentioned, that fire severity, the high severity fire in particular, has not increased in most regions. There's a couple of places, very localized areas, one in the Southwest, where there has been some increase in the last 20 years. Whether that will continue is unknown, but that was a surprise. And the other one that's interesting to me is that some of the dangers of human-caused climate change are that we could actually get too much fire in some ecosystems, but we could get too little in others. And one of the lessons is we probably can't expect a sort of cookie-cutter homogenous effect. In some areas, we may get more fire due to hotter, drier conditions. In other areas, we might get less fire due to warmer and wetter conditions. And we are seeing precipitation, especially summer precipitation, increase in some areas. And that could actually have a real adverse impact in ways that people wouldn't expect on a lot of fire-dependent wildlife species that already have too little habitat.
So there really is a Goldilocks place. You're going to have too much fire, you're going to have too little fire as well.
Exactly.
Wolfgang in Sunny Valley is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Chad Hansen and Dominic Della Sala.
Good morning. It's a wonderful subject. It's one that's close to my skin, truly. Because we live in the forest, and I pray every day for rain. I mean, if there's lightning, please don't let it hit here, because we have no place to go. But which gets me to the three problems that I see. It's people, and people. And with people, number one, I mean people like us, but on a large scale, places like Lancaster, the whole Southern California urbanization into a place that should be left alone, And then the second issue is people caused fires. I mean, even if I see a glass bottle off the road, I'm going to stop and pick it up because it could be the glass bottle that kills me. And the third one is, of course, the toughest one. And that's greed. If somebody just mentioned, I don't know, Chad or Dominic, that people think that they can log their way out of fires, and at the same time, clear cuts make higher temperatures. Clear cuts increase stream temperatures and all that. But how can we get to them? How can we address the greed?
All right, that was Dominic that said that, so we'll let him pick it up from there. Thanks for the call, Wolfgang.
Oh, yeah, there's so much to unpackage in that. It's a great series of comments. Please take a look at the book, and we deal with this in the closing chapter in many respects. I think, first and foremost, the issue of, how do you survive these big burns if you live in a forest and you're in fire habitat? We talk about the concept of fire sheds. Everybody knows what a watershed is, but, there's a great Google image in the book of my fire shed, zeroing in on my house.
Yeah, I thought that is a new term, fire shed. I hadn't seen it before
in
this book.
And so the fire shed is just, it's kind of a social ecological concept. So you get your landowners together and you talk about defensible space, because that's where we know the science is rock solid. if you reduce your risks within like a 100 or 200 foot radius around your home and you build with fire resistant materials, your chances of surviving a big fire event go up to at least 90%. Nothing changes if you're logging in the backcountry to protect those homes. So I think that's really important. The second point that he makes is the greed factor. And I don't know if I would call it greed, but certainly there is the industrial fire suppression complex that has now turned the Forest Service, their budget in some years approaches 50% of Forest Service funds go into suppression. That's a lot of dollars. Some years, $2 billion used to fight fires that are stopped by the rains on most occasions. And so when the Forest Service was established in 1908, its budget for firefighting was $1 million. Wow. Its budget today is $1 million a day. And in some years, $2 billion to fight these fires that mostly extinguish on their own when the rains come.
We have an email here from John and Eugene. He said, and he's getting back to the discussion of the media, which you referred to in the book as the firephobic media. He says the worst term that media use is destroyed, as in 4,000 acres were destroyed by the fire. What would you prefer to see people using, Chad Hansen?
Well, we actually address this very directly in the book and suggest actually a number of terms that are just value neutral that could be used. 4,000 acres were affected. The fire spanned 4,000 acres. The fire affected 4,000 acres. But, you know, and just to be clear, you know, there are many exceptions in the media. Many reporters, print, radio, and otherwise have, you know, really started to use, you know, more value-neutral language, have started to talk about the ecological benefits of mixed-intensity fire. So it's not across the board, but there's still a problem out there.
Can we use the word burned? That's usually my favorite.
I mean, burned is fairly neutral, but typically what we see is, you know, destroyed, consumed, ravaged, nuked, et cetera. You know, we see these terms all the time, and we saw a lot of this after the 2013 RIM fire in the Sierra Nevada, and some of the most colorful and hyperbolic language that I've seen yet. And, of course, you know, talked about a lot of the media coverage, talked about moonscapes where the soil was sterilized and nothing would grow. And, you know, I've been doing research in those areas, in those largest high-intensity fire patches, and I'm finding the same thing that we found in other fires, beautiful regeneration of conifers and oaks and wildflowers and shrubs and just an abundance of wildlife.
Well, let's talk about some of the quote-unquote moonscapes that, that you two have visited. Dominic, you started off talking about a hike on Grizzly Peak with your daughter and mentioned birds, and there's a pretty good-sized section in the book about birds and what they teach us about fires. Explain that, please.
Well, let me give you an example of that. The bellwether species for a severe burn is the black-backed woodpecker. This species was designed by nature to come in immediately after a forest fire. Its black back resembles that of the charred tree. So if it's going to escape predators, it just blends right in, goes in, feeds on the woodpecker, beetle larvae, nest in those dead trees, and then moves on to the next fire event shortly after, you know, like 4 or 5 years, the habitat begins to decline for that species. It could be our spotted owl for indicator species of an entire community of fire-adapted species.
What about spotted owls in fires? I mean, how soon do they come back? There's some references in here that, that surprised me as well, that that the idea that spotted owls come back fairly quickly after a fire.
You know, it depends a lot on the extent of the fire, but what we've seen in the California spotted owl, where a lot of the studies have been done, the birds are foraging in these intensely burned patches. They're nesting in fire refugia, places that weren't where all the trees weren't all killed. And, you know, they're moving around the landscape a lot, but they seem to be quite resilient. And some birds actually come in. Some of these owls actually come into a burn area because they know, hey, that's my kitchen. And, you know, I still have my bedroom because there are some trees here that survived the fire. So it's pretty good habitat.
So you move from birds to mammals in the book. And the overall sense I get, Chad, is that the once nutrients arrive for critters on the ground to eat, and the air for that matter, that's when everything, it's kind of a if you build it, they will come thing. If you grow new vegetation, the critters come back.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, it's about the dead trees and the native you know, wood-boring beetles that are attracted to those dead trees, and that provides food for the woodpeckers, and the woodpeckers provide food for goshawks and Cooper's hawks, and then the native shrubs that come in are flowering plants typically, and they attract a lot of native flying insects, you know, bees and wasps, and and other insects, and that provides foods for fly-catching birds and for bats. And so you get this very, very rich kind of habitat. We call this in ecology trophic cascades. You're going all the way up from the insects to the smaller creatures up to the large animals.
So ultimately, is there a conclusion here? There is the conclusion that, hey, not all fires are bad, not by a long shot. But for that matter, is there an activist look at this? And I do not want anybody to take this the wrong way, but are you saying there should be more setting of fires, or at least letting more fires burn?
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Chad.
Yeah, I would say the primary thing is to let more fires burn in the backcountry, and when they do burn, is to not log them and to focus our efforts both before fires and when fires are burning on home protection so that people are protected and so that we're not unnecessarily risking the lives of firefighters fighting backcountry fires based upon outdated assumptions about fires destroying forests.
Yeah, and I would add to that the other side of the activist's timely nature of this book is we have a bill right now in the House of Representatives that came out of committee this past week, voted along party lines, that would suspend most environmental laws, expedite logging after a fire, and destroy a lot of these natural benefits that we're getting from forest fires. And we see this just about every year from members of Congress that are overreacting to the hype around these forest fires. So it's not just an academic exercise. There is some really practical policy recommendations in the book.
And this is what the environmental groups tend to call the writers from hell, where you say, okay, this is the sufficiency language. That's right. Where you say, yeah, that we're fine doing what we're doing here. Quick note about the authors. Who are all the people you pulled together for this, Dominic?
They're from all over the place. They're mostly scientists, fire ecologists. There was a former firefighter and a policy analyst. So Most people were scientists.
Where can people get the book?
They can get it on Amazon.com. Just query the name of the book, and you could even look for Nature's Phoenix, and it'll probably pop up.
All right. The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix, Dominic Della Sala, Geos Institute's President and Chief Scientist, Chad Hansen, Director and Staff Ecologist at the John Muir Project of the Earth Island Institute. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.